What's up, my friend? Welcome back to another episode of the Year of Plenty podcast, the show to help you get closer to your food source and learn the skills so that every year can be a year of plenty. This show is all about making you a more resilient human through food, and the topics we discuss revolve around hunting, fishing, foraging, homesteading, nutrition, ancestral foodways, and so much more. Welcome back. As always, I'm your host, Poldy Wieland, and today's episode is a conversation with my friend Luke Oswald, who is a hunter, angler, forager, and podcaster himself. On his show called Publicly Challenged, Luke interviews wild food experts, naturalists, and others who utilize public lands recreationally. His goal is for him and his listeners to learn how to hunt, fish, and forage, and do it all in a more sustainable manner. So just based on all of this, I think it's pretty clear that he operates on a very similar wavelength as myself and a lot of you guys, and I had an absolute blast talking to him. I think you guys will really enjoy this episode. So now for a quick episode overview, though, so you know what to expect from it. We start out talking about hunting hawks with a spear and why Luke decided to go after that and do that pursuit. Then we get into the ethical considerations when hunting with a spear and the lessons learned during the wild hog hunt and what Luke would do differently next time. Following that, we talk about canning wild game meat and why Luke wants to get a freeze dryer to make his own backpacking meals. After that, we get into another segment, which is all about tapping maple and black walnut trees for syrup. And here, Luke shares his favorite tool for actually cracking the black walnuts, which, let me tell you from experience, can be a huge pain. So I was very happy to hear about this tool. Along the lines of maple syrup tapping, I also share a Native American legend about how Chief Voxis and his wife discovered maple sap and maple syrup. I'm always a big fan of legends and myths around the things we do, so I decided this would be a good place to share it. Now, during this conversation, Luke also shared a tidbit that was very fascinating to me, and it's all about how European settlers acquired salt for cooking when they came to the New World. Now, I'm sure there are many ways they did this, but I thought this one was really unique and something that I might have to try myself one day. And then finally, toward the end, we talk about foraging for service berries and how to utilize them in the kitchen. So lots of good stuff in this episode. And before we get into it, let me share a quick word from my podcast sponsor, Montana Block. Montana Block is offering you guys 15% off their entire store online with the code Year of Plenty. Now, Montana Block is a small family-owned business from Billings, Montana, and they make beautiful, functional wooden kitchen utensils, everything from high-quality end-grain butcher blocks to magnetic knife holders that you can use to display your favorite kitchen knives. I have several of their products now, including this giant custom cutting board that you can actually buy from them now that can fit an entire elk quarter. So we've been kind of using it as our everyday cutting board in the kitchen. It takes up the whole like island space, but I'm also super excited to use it for butchering elk later in the year this year. My favorite part about Montana Block is that they really pour their heart and soul into every single product. Everything is handcrafted and all their materials come from the US. So the wood, the glue, it's all American made. And that's something you don't see often anymore these days. So help support Montana Block, help support this podcast, and use the code Year of Plenty on their website, which is emptyblock.com, for 15% off their entire shop. And then part of that sale will also kick back to the podcast. So it's a great way to help support your favorite food podcast here. Now, one more thing. I do want to mention that I am uploading video podcasts now on X, formerly Twitter, under the highlight section, and then in the very near future, they'll also be on YouTube. So if you want to watch the video podcast, go to the link in the podcast episode description if you're listening to the audio only right now, and check out the video podcast over there. Okay, that's it. Way too long of an intro, so let's get straight into this episode with Luke Oswald. Luke Oswald, how's it going, my man? Welcome to the Year of Plenty podcast.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on, and it's going great. So looking forward to talking to you. Last time we had a wonderful conversation, and we'll probably have another one today. So,
100%. Last time I was in your podcast, Publicly Challenged, great podcast for all things wild food, foraging and hunting and fishing, right?
Yeah.
How's that been going for you?
Really, really good. We took on a co-host, Clay Bowers, and we're just trying to crank them out and get as much quality content to the consumers as we can.
Heck yeah. And I've had Clay on this podcast as well. He's a great guy. So I'm really happy to hear that he's joining you now. And you guys are coming together to create some awesome podcast episodes. I haven't listened to the last few because you guys, have definitely been cranking out, I think, like one a week or so.
Yep.
And, you know, that's a good schedule to keep up. I hope to be there. Maybe I need to bring in a co-host too. I've been bringing in my girlfriend every once in a while, and she's been really, really enjoying it. So that's good. At least she was so shy at the beginning, didn't want to podcast at all. And I'm like, hey, it's just an interesting conversation, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that's the fun part about it is you get to have an interesting conversation with so many people, and being able to record with a lot of the guests that we've had recently is just amazing to hear their stories. I mean, people like Donnie Dust, to where, I mean, that guy can, you know, just tell a story and make you get so entranced and wrapped up in the story that you forget where you are in the moment, and you just feel yourself in his words. So it's pretty cool to talk to people like that and just have a wonderful, wonderful experience conversation and actually take away something, and not only take away something, but educate the listener as well.
100%. That's what it's all about. And that's, story. I mean, that's why podcasting for me is still my favorite, like, form of media. And I think it's only growing from here on out. A lot more people are getting into it, and people are finally know what a podcast is. So that's good. I'm happy to see that trend continue, because when I started a few years ago, there was so many people that I'm like, hey, have you listened to a podcast? And you're like, what's a podcast? So it's good to see that happening. One thing we wanted to chat about that we kind of talked about when I was on your podcast before we hit the record button, I think actually, was you've been on a spear hunt, a hog hunt, I believe, right?
Yep.
So like, that is something I have never really discussed on the podcast at all ever. And it's super interesting to me. You know, we have all these new weapons to go hunting, but there's still this allure to getting back to the true, like, forms of hunting, and spear hunting is definitely, I mean, that's as old as hunting is, right? So yeah. I'm just curious, like, how did you first become interested in the whole spear hunting, and like, what kind of drew you to that method?
Well, I've been on hog hunts before, and to be honest, it didn't really appeal to me. And I killed a way larger hog the first time I went hunting. So it was just, the meat wasn't good and the hunt wasn't that thrilling. I used a gun, and for me, gun hunting, I don't have anything against it, but for me, I like getting up close and personal with the animals, whether it be archery equipment or in this case a spear. And it draws me in. Anything primitive makes me feel like I'm catching, or makes me feel like I'm connecting with like a something prehistoric in my DNA, something that's traced back all the way to my ancestors, and I just feel a connection. And I love primitive things, primitive archery and everything. And if I had more time, I would definitely only use primitive equipment. But modern compounds, you get them dialed in, and as long as you keep your form and you shoot a few arrows every once in a while, it kind of stays. It's not instinctive like shooting a traditional bow or anything like that. So if I get more time, though, I'm definitely going to pick up the trad bow again and start doing that. But spears have just always appealed to me, and I started looking at different cultures, whether it be European boar hunting or going all the way back to the Germanic tribes hunting boars with spears from the Stone Age into the Bronze Age, you know, into the Iron Age, and just really, really neat to see the history behind that. And with doing that, it just kind of stuck with me. And I'm like, man, I should really do that. And ended up booking a hunt just to get friends together and kind of knock the rust off with archery equipment. We ended up going to a ranch down in Texas that was archery or blades or spears only. And when I saw that in the description, it just sparked something in my mind. And I was like, okay, you know what? I'm going to get a spear and I'm going to practice with it. And so I actually got two different spears. I got a traditional European boar spear, which has like the ferrule on the end of the blade or like a T-bar so that it can't work its way up the blade. And then I got another one that's like a Samburu style, which is the African hunting style that's meant for throwing. And I got the Slockmaster one. So it's Tim Wells's spear. And I got that and started playing around with that, throwing the spear. I quickly learned that throwing a spear versus dropping it, there's a big difference. Dropping a spear is fairly easy and effective. And that's basically like when you're a kid and you play the game where you drop a clothespin into like a mason jar or a bottle or a penny into something. And, you know, it's just you find that sweet spot and you can drop it, but and you can be fairly consistent at that. But throwing a spear, I found that my effective range was about 7 yards. Anything further than that, it was all over the place. Now I know some people can throw better than that and further than that, but in my case, that was my effective range. So I went kind of knowing that and knowing I could only be a few paces from an animal. But nonetheless, went to the ranch, tried throwing at a running boar, completely just miffed it. Just spear was like 3 feet in front of it. It ran, jumped over the spear and just kept running, you know? And I'm like, okay, this is, you know, definitely not the scenario, but I kept with the spear, kept it in my hands. And then later on that day, a friend of mine and I had one quartered and you could tell it was just mad. And that boar turned and looked
screaming,
looked at me, let out a scream and just charged full bore at me. And sidestepped just a little bit and drove that spear right through the animal. And it's crazy to think, though, how minimal of resistance that spear has. Like, would you shove a broadhead through something or a target or you're practicing with the target, how easily it goes in? Now imagine a larger, I mean, you're talking a spear tip that's, you know, 7 inches long and 3 inches wide at the base. And just being able to push that thing through with zero resistance, I'm talking like a hot knife through butter. And it just goes in all the way out the other side and stuck into the dirt. And here's this animal just bleeding all over the place and just trying still to work its way up and try and gore me with its tusks. And just the adrenaline was pumping. I mean, it's crazy.
I mean, those boars are, it's wild how much energy they have. And, you know, I'm assuming it was maybe a male. They have a lot of testosterone in them too. And they're just a really hardy, hardy animal. And, you know, that's interesting though. You bring that up because I think a lot of people would look at, you know, spear hunting and maybe like have some ethical concerns in terms of like, is this going to be a clean kill? Is it, you know, going to be as effective as a rifle and whatnot? But the way you did it here, the way you just told the story sounds like, I mean, sounds like you got that spear through there and that animal bled out pretty quick too.
So to put it in perspective, when you shoot an arrow into one, and earlier it was either that day or the day before that, I put, I think, 3 of my own arrows and one was a double lung shot. And then my co-host Clay with his crossbow put an arrow and I think his kid put an arrow into that. And it was still alive 20 minutes later, still just hanging on to every little, well, maybe it wasn't 20 minutes, but it seemed like it with all the commotion and everything, you know how that goes. But I mean, at least 12 minutes later, that animal is still alive as we're running up to it. In fact, when I came up to it, Clay was trying, he had his knife out and a long stick in his hand and was trying to corral it and put a knife into it. And I was like, what are you doing? Like, you're going to get attacked. And it just puts into perspective that many arrows with lethal shots still did not put that animal down. But the spear I put into it, It expired within seconds, although in the heat of the moment, it seemed like time stood still and it was, you know, an eternal moment. But in reality, that thing bled out in a matter of, I don't know, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, and that animal expired. In fact, at that point, while it was still trying to climb up that spear, my friend Tim came running over and took the European boar spear and put it through its heart. I mean, it was game over, and that animal instantly died after that. But it's just, wow. It's crazy to have that happen. But because of that experience and seeing the effectiveness of that spear, it makes me want to use it a lot more.
Yeah, right. And I mean, you were really close, but you know, having a 7-inch big piece of sharp, you know, dagger-like metal go through it, yeah, I think that's going to cause a lot of damage and definitely make that animal expire pretty darn fast. So you said you used, for that one, you used more the African style spear then?
I did. That's right. What I had in my hand. I planned on throwing a spear, you know, at a short range if I could. And it ended up being to where I didn't even have a chance to throw one other than the one throw. And we ended up coming up on one and had it cornered. And it did not like being backed into a corner. And when that happened, it looked at my friend, looked at me. Maybe it thought I was the easier choice. I'm not sure. But it went at me, and that was game over for that animal.
Yeah, and they will. I mean, I've seen those videos of boars chasing people up a tree and whatnot, and just hunting them in Germany. I know that they can be really standoffish, especially with dogs. It happens all the time in German drive hunts where dogs just get, you know, gutted. And it's definitely something you need to want for your dog. But you know, those dogs, they still love doing it. They're all about it. And it's not, you know, what I know about it with this, at least the European spears in medieval times, often what they would do is like knee down and let that boar charge them and then really stick it with the spear then as it's, you know, coming at them. And then, is that kind of, cause you mentioned that it was kind of working itself up the spear. So were you still holding the spear as it's kind of coming at you, or?
Yes. I was holding onto that spear. I didn't want it to run off. Wow. And so the blade was actually drove into the mud. It was really muddy at the time. It was in the springtime. And, so the spear point itself was drove into the mud and had it semi pinned down, and I'm holding on to the top side of the spear, and it worked its all the way up about a good 2 feet up to like the handle where you hold on to like the grip. Think of like a golf club grip.
Wow.
It worked its way all the way up to that. So a good couple of feet up, because that's in the middle of the spear as you throw it. So pretty.
Man, I can't imagine what that, like, you're feeling in you in that moment, like, it must have been crazy.
Yeah. I mean, it was just gnashing its teeth and making blood curdling screams. But no, it was an amazing experience. The adrenaline, once it kind of wore off, you know, I put everything in perspective and I was like, wow, that was, to me, that was the best chance an animal has ever had in a hunting scenario as for survival. I mean, it was either me or him, right? And he knew that coming at me. And fortunately, it was me and not or him and not me. But, you know, it could have been me just as well. And he could have torn me up, but it didn't happen that way. So, it was interesting. And it's kind of put the bug into me to try and spear more things. I really wish you could spear elk or something like that. Can you imagine just sitting over a wallow and waiting for a big bull to come in and just dropping a spear right from the top side, right into the chest cavity?
Yeah.
And the cool part about it, though, if you think about it, with a 7-inch blade dropping all the way into the center of the chest cavity as it pierces through. Now that animal runs away and that tail piece of the spear is hanging out, just slashing through the internals. I mean, with an arrow, if you get a clean pass through, you've got one wound channel. You're not making multiple wound channels like you would with the spear. So the ethics, a lot of times, you know, people look at it in the wrong light or the wrong perspective. If anything, you know, people may look at it as violent, which yes, it is, but it's amazingly effective. The only thing I could say is if somebody was throwing a spear and they weren't at least practiced in it, and they, you know, made a lot of bad shots where they were hitting it in like extremities or something, it could be a different story. But anywhere within that body cavity is going to do so much trauma that that animal is just going to expire quickly.
Yeah, that's good to hear, especially for people listening who, you know, might have some ethical concerns. And it's just, like you said, it's so much more primal, and it's just got to be so much more intimate than shooting an animal from like 400 yards with a rifle. You know, you're not yeah. there in the action. Like, you're there when you're looking through your scope, but that's about it. So it's got to be very, very special. And you mentioned that you know, were prepping beforehand. Like, what did kind of the training look like?
I climbed up on my garage roof a couple times and dropped the spear into a 3D target. I did that quite a bit. And then what's cool about the Slockmaster spear, the Tim Wells spear, is that it has a changeable tip, so you could change it from a spear point to a field point, and they're weighted exactly the same. So you can utilize the practice tip without actually ever damaging or dulling your spear point. So that's pretty cool. But I used that field point and dropped it quite a few times from my garage roof onto a 3D target. And then I would set up the 3D target in various locations behind cover and just utilize things for different cover and stuff. And then I'd try and sneak up on it, get within range and throw it, practice throwing it like that too. And that's fun. That's fun within itself.
Yeah.
I mean, if your neighbors drive by and see you doing that, then you think you're an extreme weirdo or something.
I was about to say, I was about to ask, did any of your neighbors see you do this?
I'm sure they did. What is he doing? You know what? Honestly, that's not really out of the norm for me. So between walking around barefoot and picking dandelions and everything else in the yard. So
yeah, it's just the primal way, right?
Right.
So would you say this kind of tested your ability as a hunter too? And like, was it very different from like other experiences? I mean, you kind of alluded to it already with just having that in close encounter, but
yeah, I mean,
overall, do you think it tested you?
I don't know if it necessarily tested me, because I've always tried to see how close I could get to animals anyway. It's just something I love doing, especially archery hunting. When I used a traditional bow, I used a long bow for a couple of years, and when I did that, I tried stalking mostly. And stalking, I mean, I obviously with the longbow, I wanted to get as close as possible anyway. So most of my shots were inside of 20 yards, and that kind of had the same feeling. And to be honest, it didn't matter what size animal it was at that point. I just wanted to get on it and use that bow and try and hone my skills. So I got just as much thrill from killing a turkey or killing, you know, a doe that it would have been a 200-inch buck. It didn't matter. And I love that feeling, right. You know, it brings you back to something that sometimes you don't get, like the first time you ever went deer hunting and it was archery hunting and you got the buck fever, that first deer walks out in front of you and your heart's pounding out of your chest. You get that feeling again. And I love that.
Yeah. It's just ingrained in us. It feels right. It feels good, as weird as it sounds, but it's definitely part of the human experience. And, you know, some people like us still seek it out, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
No.
So, how much meat did you end up getting from that boar?
I ended up taking two, and between, you know, and honestly, I didn't weigh it, but I'd say probably deboned 40 pounds of meat. Like, they were smaller hogs, like under 65, 70 pounds, I'd say. So, a decent amount of meat. And a lot of it I ground up and turned into breakfast sausage. My buddy did that with his previous boar on a different hunting trip than the one where mine tasted horrible, because I tried utilizing it as regular cuts of barbecue meat and doing stuff on the smoker, and it just didn't turn out well. He did that, and it just, with a little bit of seasoning and grinding it up, it really makes it go a long way. And so I made a lot of breakfast sausage. But one of the most favorite things that I did was actually making Canadian bacon. So Larry White does a bunch of different stuff, and I got his recipe and utilized it. And you take it, soak it in a brine for 7 days, and after that you pat it dry and let it sit on like a cookie sheet in the fridge and let it kind of dry out a little bit. And then you take that and you smoke it on the smoker for a couple hours until whatever the internal temp, I can't remember, 180 or 175, whatever it is. And then you take it from there and it's ready to slice up and cook in the pan. Or I froze a bunch and I'll break it out every once in a while and slice off some pieces for breakfast. And it's wonderful.
Oh, I bet.
If I get more, I'm going to do, you know, so hopefully this year, being that that was last year, hopefully this year, if I go on another boar hunt and only use a spear, that I'm going to definitely make some more Canadian bacon.
Yeah, that's something I never really thought about doing with boar in Germany when we got them there, is actually make bacon with them. But they can get really fatty too, you know, just like a livestock pig. Especially if you're having good feed out there.
The loins. So I took the loins and made like a Canadian bacon style, which is more of like a ham, you know, like a cured smoked ham sliced up, not actual bacon. Okay. There was definitely not enough belly fat to make a traditional American bacon with it.
Okay. So more of the loin. Yeah. So that's, that's more like the backstrap, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. That's sweet. I've not played around with that, but wonder if I could make a Canadian bacon with just like a fatty dough. I'd have to look into that. That would be kind of cool.
I think you could.
I don't know if you've ever tried to do that.
Are you talking out of the belly meat or out of like the skirting?
No, out of the loin.
Or out of the back straps.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd want to waste those back straps.
Might be interesting. Yeah. But it's fun to experiment too, you know?
Like, it definitely is. You could definitely brine that and smoke it.
Right. Yeah, and I'm trying to just find more and more ways to utilize different cuts. But I know there's like a stereotype of got to eat the back straps how they are and whatnot. And
oh, I don't know about that. I know a lot of people that wrap them in bacon, and I'm like, what's the point of that? Like, if you're trying to add fat or something, but to dilute the wonderful taste of the venison with the bacon, to me, it just seems like blasphemy. It's something that shouldn't be done. Absolutely shouldn't be done. I like meat to taste like meat, not to taste like bacon. Not that there's anything wrong with bacon, but do that with something that tastes terrible, like a goose breast.
Yeah, it does take away from the flavor a lot. Although I've been like, I used to be like, always like have that same mentality and I wouldn't even make grind. And now I've been all about like, I love making as much grind as I can and adding in, I do grass-fed, grass-finished tallow, like from cattle, not pigs. And I'm all about that right now just because of how simple and versatile ground can be. And then one time I actually made I got a roadkill and I made grind from the whole thing, like back straps, tenderloins in there and everything. And it was some of the best grind I've ever had. Oh, just because I think, you know, some of those pieces were in there.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, that's like getting like a prime cut burger or something, which would be amazing, you know. But I use a lot of grind as well, so it's not like we don't. But although my new thing this year that I did that I haven't done before was a lot more canning of the venison, and I would cut up chunks of my quarters and then take them into like 1-inch cubes and put them into a mason jar. And then Italian seasoning, and then cover them in beef broth, and then pepperoncinis in there, and a little bit of the brine from the pepperoncinis too, and then pressure can that, and then it turns into Italian beef.
Wow!
So you can open up that jar and make, you know, like a pulled Italian beef sandwich out of that, and it's phenomenal. Put a little jardinera on top of it on a roll, and it's wonderful. And it takes like a minute to heat up, maybe two.
Right.
So in a pinch, that's definitely a go-to meal.
Or you can eat it cold too, which I like eating meats cold. Yeah. And, you know, I haven't like my grandma, my Italian grandma, she always makes like a meat salad, and it's literally like meat, onions, vinegar, and that's it. And some olive oil. And
is it raw meat?
It's super good. No, she makes it with like, so she'll cook the meat like in a stock, in a soup first. Once it's fully cooked, take it out and then cut it like almost to the point where it's falling apart, and then cut into really thin strips, and then mix that with the vinegar, the olive oil, and onions, and let that like sit for 2 hours. And it's so good. It's so good.
It sounds good.
It's super simple. super simple, but that's what I'm all about. And yeah, the canning meat thing, yeah, that's special. It's just I'm also trying to experiment more with that right now. What kind of canner are you using? Do you remember the name of it?
It's a Presto. It's a Presto 30 quart, I think, pressure canner. So I would like to get a larger one so you can actually put, because you can only put 7 quarts in it. I'd like to get one where you could double stack quart jars. And then, I mean, you could really maximize your yield. Otherwise, it just takes a long time. Sometimes I run 2 canners. I've got like a 26 quart and a 30 quart, and I'll get them both going at the same time to try and speed up the process.
And have you ever had any issues with like things not canning right with that one? Or because I was looking at the Presto 2 online.
You'll know. So the Presto has like a seal in it. And if you're willing to just, which I should have done, because one was given to me and the other one I bought. And the reason I bought the other one is because I can actually put quart jars and pint jars in it in the 30 quart, but you can't do it in the 20, 24, 26, whatever it is. But they both have a seal on them, and then they have a seal. And I've had to replace the seal, not on the lid, but on the safety mechanism, or maybe not safety mechanism, but the pressure port to where the weight goes on. And the newer style that has no seal whatsoever, I think it's an all-American canner, and you just put a little bit of oil on it and it's metal to metal and you tighten the knobs down. But that way, apocalyptic scenario or whatever, you don't ever have to worry about replacement parts. Or just in general, it's going to last you a lot longer because you don't have to worry about those replacement parts, those gaskets and seals. If you're looking to get one, it's kind of like buy once, cry once is what I always say. Just I'd probably go for that one if I did it all over, and I'd get the one where I could get 2 quarts. Now, granted, if you've got like a hood on your range, a range hood or anything like that on your stove and you're doing it indoors, might be kind of difficult to get that underneath it, depending on how low your range hood is. But if you don't and you've got a stove top where it's open or something like that, I'd definitely go with the largest one I could get.
Yeah. My girlfriend's dad just got the all-American one. I think it's made in Milwaukee, actually, or Wisconsin or something like that.
Yep.
And they look really solid. We made canned salmon because over the summer we went on a Washington salmon fishing trip and we got over 52 salmon, and he canned a bunch of those. And
that's awesome.
Worked great. Like yeah, that's the next big frontier for me too, is just canning my meat 100%.
Yeah. I've got like 14 jars of venison that I've done right, well, this season. So I decided to take up less freezer space and start doing it that way. And I mean, think about it. You're not even consuming any energy. It's just sitting there ready to go. And I know it says like 2 to 3 years is the most it lasts, but I've seen YouTube videos of people opening up stuff that's 5-7 years old and it's still good.
That's awesome. Sweet. Well, it's definitely on the list for me to do in the next few months here. As soon as trade show season is over, that's kind of what I want to experiment with. But I'll probably get the All-American. I looked, they were like $300 to $400, maybe even a bit more, but I think it's worth it. Like you said, buy once, cry once. I'm all about that with my gear, kitchen and hunting gear.
Yeah, so the next big purchase for me is probably a freeze dryer, I think.
Hey, sorry for the interruption, but I want to jump in real quick to let you know how you can best support the Year of Plenty podcast. First of all, make sure you hit that follow button in your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. Then please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And if you leave a review, you can send me a screenshot to either my email address, my Instagram, or X profile. And once I have that screenshot, I'm going to provide you a link to my food preservation ebook for free. So that's definitely something to take advantage of. And if you have friends who you think would get value from the show here, send them an episode and please bring them along for the ride. The more, the merrier. Now, one more thing, if you really want to help support the show is beyond like buying from Montana Block with the code Year of Plenty, you can also become a patron of the show over on Patreon for as little as $2 a month. That's greatly appreciated and really, really helps me keep the lights on. Links to everything I just talked about will be in the podcast episode description. Easy for you to find there. Okay, that's it. Thank you so much for listening and supporting the show. Let's get back to the episode.
That's something that's been on my list for a long time, and I've just put it off because of the price tag. But I mean, if you think about all the money that I've probably spent on hunting meals or camping meals that are dehydrated or freeze dried, I started doing my own dehydrated, but they just don't last as long. And I found that I end up losing a lot of the flavor, and I keep them in the freezer so they keep longer, and I'll pull them out and utilize them, you know, within that week or two that I pull them out. But if I could have a freeze dryer and once again, not have to use that freezer space and just keep them on a shelf, that's the way to go.
100%. Yeah. I've been making my own meals too like that, and it's been working pretty great, but you do want to use them pretty quickly if you don't freeze them. And then if you freeze them, like you said, like a week after, just do it that way. But you can do a lot with a dehydrator too there. And a freeze dryer is definitely, the next level thing to get. And those meals can last like what, 20 years?
When 20 you to 30 years. Them. Yeah. Just on the shelf, just sitting there with the, you know, in a Mylar bag. So, that's pretty cool. My wife just got me a new vacuum sealer because mine kind of finally went out, and the new one's got those, the mason jar lids. So now I want to start putting stuff in the mason jars and vacuum sealing the mason jars. And I started thinking about it the other day, and I'm like, man, that would be a great way to like marinate jerky, is put it all in a 1/2 gallon jar and just put all my stuff in it and just vacuum seal it so it pulls all of that marinade into the jerky.
Yeah.
So that's probably my next project that I'm going to do for sure.
Do you know what that thing is called? I need a new vacuum sealer too.
The one she got me is a Food Saver. I don't remember what model. It's one of the bigger ones, and it's got like a vacuum attachment thing on the side, and you just pull off the bottom piece of it and put it. There's a mason jar, two different size mason jar lids for the regular mouth and the wide mouth, and you put the regular canning lid on it, and you set that right on top, and then you plug in the piece to it, and then just hit the vacuum seal, and it vacuums it to where there's no air left in the jar.
That's cool. See, I didn't even know that was a thing. Learned something new.
I actually saw there's a girl I follow on Instagram called Barefoot Mimosas, and she's always vacuum sealing stuff in mason jars. She buys flour in bulk and vacuum seals that so it stays fresh longer.
Yeah, why not? That makes a lot of sense. And then that way you have it always when you need it. I'm loving how like a lot more people are going back to wanting to learn these skills and, you know, taking food sovereignty into their own hands and really becoming more self-sufficient like that. It's nice to see that the last few years, just more normal, like normal people, you know, not like nerds like us getting into that stuff again and realizing the value of it. Because I mean, heck, you know, with the power grid and all that, if you don't have a fridge, if you don't have your electronic cooking stove, like you're pretty vulnerable. You know, there's a lot that could go wrong pretty easily. One solar flare and you can't cook anymore and keep your food fresh. And all of our like grandparents, you know, like they all had these skills. They still knew how to do all that. It was normal for everyone to at least have something in the pantry. And that's easy to use and easy to heat up and whatnot. So I'm excited to just learn more and more about that as well. It's like with anything, it's just a constant learning process and experimentation, trying new things out. It's sweet. So, you know, to close off the boar hunting segment, if you were to go again spear hunting, what would you do different? Is there anything kind of you reflected on that you think you would improve or just do differently in general?
Yeah, probably. And that would be make sure my spear is with me at all times. There was a few opportunities that where I grabbed the bow thinking I was just going to back up a friend or something or help put an extra arrow in something if need be and carry my bow with me. And then I ended up having multiple opportunities to stock up on these animals and didn't have my spear with me to try and use it. So just keep the spear with me at all times, I would say.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And learn how to turn a camera on too, because I had my GoPro and I thought it was off when it was on, and then ended up actually turning it off and not getting any footage. So
that's happened to me so many times when I'm like ice fishing. That's usually when it happens to me. And that's exactly when you get that big catch too. It's like, dang it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So quick question about the boar. Did you ever eat any of that boar with your homemade maple syrup?
No, actually, I don't think I did. The syrup last year, I didn't get that much of it. I tap walnut trees a lot because I've got a lot of walnut trees. And I actually tap silver maples too, but I like to try and keep the walnut sap separate because it's got a nuttier flavor to it. That's almost like a nutty caramely taste to it versus that traditional kind of maple syrupy, smoky type of syrup taste. And so I like to keep that separate just because it tastes so good. And I like to actually glaze black walnuts with the walnut syrup and then put a little bit of like cinnamon, some other stuff on them and utilize that for a snack. Sometimes I'll take it and candy those nuts, then crush them up and put it on top of brie and melt it in the oven. That's pretty good too. So, and add a little bacon to that. And oh my gosh, that's a good meal.
Ooh.
But even though it shouldn't be a meal, but I mean, it's a lot of calories. But
well, hey, I think if you're going to get something sugary, do it through like maple syrup or honey or fruit. And I've been really liking right now I'm doing full keto again since 2024. But last year I experimented a bit more with like, you know, more sugars, natural sugars. And I would love just dumping a little bit of or just sprinkling a little bit of maple syrup on like a steak or something. It's so good. People, if you're listening right now, you've never just put like straight up maple syrup on your steak or backstrap. It's a game changer. It's so good.
I'm going to have to try that.
yeah, try it out. You know, literally just a meat and a maple syrup. You won't regret it. And a little bit of salt, of course. What about the black walnuts? Have you found a good way to crack them? I know that's always a challenge.
Yes. So there is a tool called Grandpa's Goody Getter. And if you go to goodygetter.com or grandpasgoodygetter.com, there's some guy that has actually made a walnut press. That's a cracker.
That's awesome.
And it works wonderfully to the point to where you can almost get a whole half out every time when you crack it. So that's impressive. And it speeds up the process. It sure beats sitting on the ground with a rock or a hammer and beating on them and picking up tiny pieces with part of the shell in there too. So
yeah,
it's the way to do it.
That's awesome.
I ended up getting one for Christmas a couple of years ago, and it's like one of the greatest tools for cracking black walnuts.
Yeah. I wish we had them here in Montana. I haven't heard of them being around, but I should have gotten something like that when I lived in Wisconsin. Cause how we usually did it, we would put them in a tarp and like drive over them with the car, and that worked too. But you know, that's how you get some looks from your neighbors.
That's a good way to really tear up a good tarp, though.
Yeah, that too. It probably wasn't, you know, college kids, not the smartest, but it worked. And then the other way, I've just done it with a good old hammer, like you said. But I'll have to look into that tool. I'm hoping to maybe just go out to Wisconsin when they're dropping and just get a bunch of walnuts and acorns. I really want to experiment with acorns more. But going back to the syrups, so I'm curious, like, when did you start doing that? And like you mentioned, you've done black walnuts and maples. Are there any other trees that you've tried so far?
I haven't really tried anything. I know you can do poplar trees and elm trees. Obviously, you don't really, any elm trees that are left or alive, you don't really want to mess with those because you don't want them to get infected with the Dutch elm disease. And by drilling through into that cambium layer, you really risk the tree getting damaged. So I wouldn't recommend that. But like I said, I know you can do those. I don't have any sycamore trees, but if I find a place, I'd like to try it. I know they don't produce as much sugar, so it's definitely going to take, I think it's like, you know, 0.05% sugar or something like that versus, or 0.5% of sugar versus like 1% sugar per sap. But I mean, sometimes I'll drink a couple glasses, especially when I first tap a tree, I'll drink a couple glasses of that that sap to just try and replace minerals or anything that's been lost over the long winter. It just feels right. I know a lot of native cultures did that as well, and so I try and do that. But I mostly tap silver maples because there's a lot of them in the area. But I mean, it, pretty much any maple tree, and a lot of people don't know that, that you can tap pretty much any maple tree, any walnut tree. And then, of course, you can do, like, I think hickory bark, you could take it and boil the bark and add a little bit of sugar, and it makes a really good syrup, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of trees that work. Like, I've done birch before, just used that sap to make mead. I never tried to actually make syrup, but I'm curious about the whole process. So how does it kind of work from beginning to end? Like, what equipment are you, like, have you been using? Because everyone does it a little different. And then, like, what does your process look like for turning it into syrup?
So I've done it a couple different ways. I've used the traditional spiles with the buckets that you put underneath. So it's a metal one. You start out with a drill bit and drill a hole into the tree. You're only drilling through the bark, which is typically about, you know, an inch thick of bark, and then you're drilling about another inch into the hole. You're getting through into that soft layer on the underneath the bark, and then the sap goes flowing through that. And you don't actually have to get into the heartwood or anything. And sap just starts flowing and coming out of it. It's pretty amazing to watch. But I tried using the traditional spiles with the buckets. Then I went to the spiles with the tubing, and that works a lot better. I mean, if you wanted to get really primitive out of it, you could actually take, you know, branches and carve your own out of wood and make like a wooden dowel that's tapered and drill a hole through the center and do that. That's what they traditionally did. And then drive that into the tree. But, you know, I prefer the tubing and the buckets because I can actually run, depending on the walnut trees that I use, some of them are about, you know, 3 foot in diameter. So they're big trees. You can get about four spiles in each tree or three spiles. And then you can just run all those tubes into one bucket. And that way I do like a 5 gallon food grade bucket with a lid on it. And when you put that lid on it and you drill holes and you shove that tubing through there, now you don't have all the bugs. If you do it the other way, you definitely have to filter it because there's all kinds of flies, ants, and everything else in there. Not saying that you can't eat them, but I don't prefer to. And so I can pour it straight into a pan. And a lot of times I just use like a stock pot and do it on the stove. But definitely open up your windows or crack your windows because it's going to get a little moist in there, like a jungle or a rainforest after a while, because your humidity in your house is, which is good if you're growing mushrooms in your house or something, because you're going to get up to that 70-80% humidity in your house pretty quick, because you're taking, you know, 12 gallons or however many gallons you're boiling down, turning that into a gallon or a quart. So there is a lot of, actually a pint, to be honest. If you're doing, it takes me normally one whole pot to get a pint. So that's, you know, 4 gallons to get a pint of syrup. So it's a lot for a little bit, but it's worth it.
I think it's usually like 40 to 60 gallons of sap for maple, at least, will give you 1 gallon of maple syrup. And then I think for birch, it was like 80 to 90 last time I looked it up.
Yeah, it's a lot less. Super bitter. Birch is a super bitter one. Like, I've never tasted birch syrup, but I got to imagine without a little bit of work, that's going to definitely not taste as good.
Well, so the sap I tried was actually pretty mellow in sweetness, and then it was kind of tasted mentally. Like, it had a menthol kind of tinge
that's
to it.
Weird.
And I thought that was really unique.
I don't know. I've come to love walnut. And so my co-host Clay, he definitely makes fun of me because it calls me a weirdo, because that's not what syrup's made out of. It's supposed to be maple trees, because up in Michigan, especially where he's at, it's predominantly sugar maples. And I told him, I'm like, well, not around here. It's walnut season around here. So, but I tap a lot of the walnut trees and the silver maples. And I think, honestly, it's still less than 2% sugar, even in a sugar maple, or maybe it's right around 2%, and a silver maple is like 1.4 or whatever. So it's still, it's pretty close. I don't know why more people don't tap more trees.
Right.
There's all kinds of trees you can tap. But the walnut syrup has kind of become like my prized possession, and I almost hold on to it longer than I should. I think I've got one jelly jar left of it right now. That's all. I'm just kind of waiting until next sapping season before I utilize it.
Man, now you're making me hungry for some walnut syrup. I've never tried it. have you noticed that the season, kind of like when you tap, does that impact what kind of syrup you're getting? And when is usually the season when you go do it wherever you live?
So I don't think it impacts this like the flavor at all, but you can miss it. And last year I kind of caught it at the tail end. But normally it's where it's freezing temps at night and warmer than freezing temps during the day. And that's really when that sap starts flowing. And you have to catch that, because if you don't and you miss it, especially with the walnuts, I feel like it's a way shorter season. It might only be a week or two, and then they're done. They don't just produce as much sap as like a maple tree or something like that. But I will say I made a wonderful mistake. I walked away, because you have to kind of tend it pretty carefully. And I walked away and wasn't paying attention. It got wrapped up in something else. And all of a sudden I heard something popping. And I ran over and it went past the syrup stage and started turning into like caramel.
Oh, God.
So I hurried up, and I can't remember what the temp is, but it's like, you know, 235 or whatever it is. And I pulled it off and started stirring, just rapidly stirring. And when you do that, you actually make sugar. And I made walnut sugar. And it was a wonderful mistake. Too, yeah, it's super, super cool. I still got a little tiny jar of that, like a half pint of that, of just straight up sugar. So even though it was a mistake, it ended up working out. And I take that, and if I'm making something like a dessert or something, I'll kind of scrape some out of the jar and sprinkle that on top.
That's sweet. So many possibilities. And like, it's just such an awesome way to get natural sugars. And again, one of those old traditions that we've kind of forgotten. You know, you think you need to go to the store and get sugar, or buy some of these cheaper maple syrups and whatnot that aren't even maple syrup, when if you have a property, you can just tap your trees and with a pretty low investment, make some delicious syrup. And I think that's really special.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, the like early settlers that didn't have access to a grocery store or even a trading post, right? The ones that were far out that expanded in the vast hunting grounds of Kentucky and made outposts, you know, what did they have? They didn't just, oh yeah, we're going to make a trip back over the Appalachian Mountains to try and go and get more sugar. They tapped the trees. They made their own. They went to salt lakes in the springs and found high salt content springs and boiled off water until they had enough salt. You know, about the only thing they couldn't find, you know, according to all the textbooks and stuff, was lead. So that's pretty cool.
Really? I didn't know that about the salt, though. That's really fascinating, because I've always thought about that, too. Like, how did they get their salt back then, you know? But that makes a lot of sense.
Just have giant kettles ready. And thousands of gallons of water at a time. You know, they'd spend a month collecting salt for the whole year. So they'd have parties that would be salt parties, and they'd go out to these salt lakes and springs that had a high enough salt content to make it worthwhile, and they would boil it off. They'd bring these giant pots, and they'd just chop firewood and start fires, and obviously hunt and everything and eat food while they were there. But the game at the time was so thick that it was some of the best hunting grounds in the world at the time. Well, not the world, but at least the new world. And they did kill animals and eat humps off of buffalo and just boil water until they had enough salt for the year. Pretty fascinating.
Wow. Really. That's fascinating. That is cool. I'll have to look into that more. Do you know, is there a book or something you can point me to?
So they talked about it quite a bit in Robert Morgan's book. It's called Boone, and it's pretty much the life of Daniel Boone, which is pretty cool. But there's some other ones out there I can't remember, but I've read that and just some like blog posts and stuff people have talked about it. But yeah, that's how they used to do it. So you just find your place with a place with a good salt lick, you know, mineral springs.
Yeah, Heck yeah, that would be something to try for sure. And in general, I'm trying to go out here and find some really good springs to get my water from, because in Germany, we always go where my cousin lives. He walks every day to like 40 minutes to a spring and fills up water. And that's kind of his routine. And he only drinks that water now because, you know, with how polluted a lot of the other water is, especially city water and whatnot, and plastic water bottles. Right. So it's definitely like a cool just tradition to just do that, a cool routine. You know, you get your hike in, you get some really good water, and it just feels different. Like the water, yeah. When I go with him, it just feels like it's alive. Like, well, really, really good stuff.
Apparently, they've done studies and water has memory. So it may actually feel alive because it is alive, and we just haven't realized it yet. So
right.
There's a lot of neat stuff out there that we don't know. Yeah.
I want to do that. And I'm gonna see, like I said, if cottonwoods can be tapped, because that's like what I was talking about before you dropped out. But that's the one tree I have here that I can get a lot of, or that I have like a deciduous tree that's not like a coniferous, like evergreen. So I want to see if I can just tap those, the cottonwoods. There's some elm here. Elm might work. I don't know. I'll have to do some more research.
You can use elm. And if you don't use, but like I said, if you use elm, you just got to be careful that you don't damage it to where it can't protect itself and gets the Dutch elm disease.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. That's the other thing. So maybe not. But I actually found a really cool, in preparation for this, I found this like cool story I want to share quick about, you know, maple syrup, because when I was looking it up, there were a lot of like legends and mythology around it with Native Americans. And one that kept coming up was the legend of Chief Woxis. I hope I'm saying that right. Have you heard of that one before?
Uh-uh.
So it's from the Maple Sugar Book by Helen and Scott Nearing, 1950. And they say here, it's just a little excerpt I want to read quick. It says that there is an Iroquois legend about the sap of the maple and how Woxis, the Indian chief, first tasted it as a sweet syrup because he had an ingenious wife. Woxis was going hunting one day early in March. He yanked his tomahawk from a tree where he had hurled it the night before and went off off for the day. The weather turned warm and the gash in the tree, a maple, dripped sap into a vessel that happened to stand close to the trunk. Woxis's wife, toward the evening, needed water in which to boil their dinner. She saw the trough full of sap and thought that would save her a trip to get water. Anyway, she was a careful woman and didn't like to waste anything. She tasted it and found it a good little sweet, but not bad. So she used it for cooking water. And Woxis, when he came home from hunting, scented the inimitable maple aroma and from far off knew that something especially good was stewing. The water had boiled down the syrup, which sweetened their meal with maple. So says the legend, was the happy practice inaugurated. So I guess this is how they found out about maple syrups. And I was reading, that the natives, they were doing this way like before. The European settlers came, like tapping maple trees for sugar and whatnot.
I mean, obviously Europeans.
I love all that history
did it too, but they, you know, everybody used it for making syrup sugar at the time. That was your source, unless you had like cane or whatever, which was imported from, I don't know, gosh, like the Bahamas and Cuba or wherever. But that's one way of doing it. What I find that I like doing every once in a while, because it's pretty sweet for me and I don't tend to like my coffee sweet, but is making a cup or two with just the sap water and boiling the sap water and then making a cup of coffee or a pot of coffee with it. It's a nice little treat every once in a while.
That's cool.
And I enjoy that. It just adds a hint of sweetness to it, and you're getting all the minerals.
Right. I'm loving all this experimentation. And speaking about experimentation, have you ever tried aging it in any way? I know there's some methods you can use for aging syrup.
Like an oak barrel and age it or something, but no, I haven't done
that. Yeah, like a bourbon barrel, you know?
Yeah, no, I haven't done
that. You'd need a lot of syrup for that, but you need a lot of syrup. But I guess what my buddy has done with meat is he just took some like burnt oak pieces and put them in like the mead to flavor it that way. So maybe you could just use some of that and let it soak in a jar with some wood pieces in there and maybe. get some of that flavor in there.
Yeah. But one thing I do is take honey because it's a great preservative. And I put the black walnuts in the honey to preserve them after I crack them because they have so much fat in them that they'll go rancid. And that's a great way to preserve them. And I'll tell you what, taking the honey with the black walnuts and it kind of infuses the honey a little bit and putting those on like a pancake or something is wonderful.
Wow. Now you're giving me ideas. I know you can do the same with the cottonwoods, you know, I always say it wrong. I think it's called catnips, the little buds.
The buds, yeah.
They grow early in the year. Yeah, you can use those and infuse the honey like that.
I put them in alcohol and make a tincture.
Really?
Yeah.
How has that worked out?
But I do that. Yeah, and it's a great tincture. So it works. It's reduced my kids' fevers a couple times.
Wow.
So it actually works as a fever reducer and like a painkiller for like a good replacement for like a Tylenol or something like that for a headache or an aspirin. It actually works for that. And so you fill up a jar. I take like a half gallon mason jar, collect that many buds, and you want to get them when they're super resinous and sticky. And when you collect them, just fill up that jar and then pour vodka over it and just let them steep in that vodka for a few months and then press it out to where you get most of the resin along with it into the alcohol and just use that as a tincture and it works great. And it is a fever reducer. I can testify that it actually works.
And then you just use a little bit, right?
Yep. Couple drops of it. Yep. Put it in my kids' water or something so they don't taste it.
Yeah. Otherwise you'd have a
drunk kids.
have a powerful concoction there. Yeah. No more fever for years if you drink a whole glass of that.
Right.
That's awesome. So what advice would you have to someone like who's just interested in starting tapping trees? Is there anything you would want to pass on to them?
It all depends on how you want to do it and how extreme you want to go, whether you want to collect, 120 gallons, I think is what I collected in one season, versus, 4 or 5 gallons and just boil it down until you get a little tiny half of a jelly jar worth. It's up to you. My advice though, just do it. Get out there and do it. That's my advice to people. Because once you do it, you've got that knowledge, you've got that experience, and nobody can ever take that away from you.
100%. I love that. Yep. That's some great advice. That's with anything in this. And, for me too, it's all about like rediscovering this old knowledge and passing it on through the podcast to just my friends. And yeah, once you have that, no one's going to take it away from you. It's like not a materialistic thing and it's worth so much more. Just doing those old traditions. I love it. It's great. So you still want to talk a little bit about service berries? If we have time, they would be fun to get into. So we were talking about, what foraging wise, what you've been doing a lot, and you were telling me the service berries, and I think they're a great beginner, berry to get into for anyone listening who's just getting into foraging. A lot of people listening already forage, but if you're just getting into it, this is a great berry to start out with, I would say.
I'm not very good with Latin names, but Saskatoon berry, June berry, service berry. According to my friend Michael Baker, it's the best Red Bull flavor that has ever been produced is the June berry. And that's service berry or Saskatoon berry. And they grow in bushes or trees, depending on how they're trimmed, basically. And then what variety, of course, because they've been crossbred to be ornamental landscaping. And so if you find even like an industrial complex sometimes in their little landscaping oases, they'll plant them there because they have great foliage in the fall. The leaves just turn bright colors. And so they look really pretty. But in the springtime, they have little buds that turn into berries. And those berries are amazing. It's kind of like a blueberry, but less sweet, less sugars in them. But if you collect enough of them, like I started doing, you can make jam out of it. And last year, I think I made like 8 jars of jam. But I actually strain it. So technically, it's not jam, it's jelly, right? Because I strain it through a strainer.
Yeah.
But I'll take them with a little bit of liquid and put them in a blender and puree them, pour them in and let them cook down a little bit, and then pour it out of the pan through a strainer and with a, I guess it's called spatula, but a spatula, scrape the sides and press it through even more and get all the seeds and most of the skin out of there. And it turns it into just a wonderful jelly. And it's actually become my favorite jelly for any type of sandwich, toast, anything now. Pancakes even, wonderful on them. And just lovely flavor. It's almost like a mixed berry flavor, but it's got more of like a hint of blueberry to it. It's good. It's really good.
So do you still have to add sugar to that and pectin and all that?
You do add sugar. Technically, you don't have to add pectin if you don't want to. I mean, you could take apples or crab apples and make your own pectin if you wanted to. It's easier to just go to the store and get some pectin. I add one tube of liquid pectin to it just to speed up the process. Otherwise, it would take a couple hours versus 35 minutes to make a batch. But this year, I plan on making like cases full and giving it as gifts to people. So I'm going to go nuts picking them because it's me or the birds. And either way, it's going to good use. And it's not like the birds are going to starve if I pick all the berries off one bush. So that's plan.
That's the trick with most berries. Trick with most berries, get there before the birds do, right?
It's true. I mean, that's like, the biggest thing with autumn olives. I have never found autumn olives that tasted good. And I was like, oh, well, I'll just wait until it frosts, 4 or 5 days later it frosts, and I'll get out there 2 days after that frost and they're gone. The birds just strip those bushes clean. So, yeah.
Yeah. And especially with the service berries, I know I've read in the past that the birds kind of like them when they're still green. So, obviously want to wait until they're like a dark purple. That's kind of when they are the best in my experience. And they're just super flavorful. I always almost feel like they're like kind of marzipan-y. Have you ever had marzipan?
Yes.
Do you know what that tastes like?
I don't remember, but I know that. I've eaten it. But like, I don't know. To me, it's like a mixed berry. Like if you've ever mixed like strawberries and like blueberries together and made a jam, or added raspberries and blueberries to a jam, that's kind of what it reminds me of. It's got like a different, it's not so like the blueberries seem a little more acidic and it has a little less of that acid, I feel like.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely less acid. They have a bit more seeds. They have that little like, I mean, they're easy to identify, which is why I like them so much. And they have that little like on the tip, the kind of like rose looking dried. Yeah.
I can't remember what it's called. I'd have to look that up too. I'm bad with all of that. Clay's a lot better. He's the resident foraging expert. But
yeah, and I read all, I read about all these different parts of the plant, the botanical names, and then it goes in and goes out directly, and then I reread it. But it looks like, it is in the rose family, so it does kind of look like a wilted rose a little bit, like that the bulb there, I guess, where the rose flower would be growing out of, just more softer, dark purple, and it's a berry that you can eat, and it's super abundant in all. I mean, I'm pretty sure it grows all over the U.S. I have a book that actually Clay recommended that's called Native American Ethnobotany, and they have over 1,249 edible plants in there that Native Americans used, and I know, right? And but usually it's like just like a few sentences for each, so it's not super informative. But of like all those plants, the Saskatoon serviceberry made the top 10 in terms of food uses. So this is like a plant that's been used for food forever by the native people here in North America. And if you're a forager and you haven't done this yet, definitely get into serviceberries. You will have a lot of you'll just be able to pick a lot. You have a lot of fun doing it. And it's just I love picking berries. It's so like mellow and relaxing, and it's just a great thing to do out there.
Yep. As people stare at you and wonder what you're doing, or you're on a hiking trail and people are like, oh, what are you picking? Oh, you can eat those? I didn't know that. And, you tell them about it. And next thing you know, they're out there at your favorite spot, but that's okay.
This is my strategy. my strategy is usually like, yeah, it's this, but you know, they're really hard to identify. So like, you just got to make sure you really know what you're doing. You got to make sure you really know what you're doing. And usually I don't see people in my spots, but yeah, I mean, I usually look for them to service berry specifically like on the edges of forests, I would say, and then on trails is usually when you find them, at least in my experience.
And the range is pretty vast too. I mean, all the way up in the Saskatoon, you know, hence the name Saskatoon berries. So they're cold hardy. And I think they grow all the way up into like zone or south into like zone six. Is that right? Six or four, whatever it is. I don't know, whatever the warmer zone is, which is like a four. I think they grow all the way into like zone four. So it's a pretty vast plant.
I found them at all sorts of elevations too here in Montana. Like down here in the valley, they're really abundant. And then if I go up to like 6,000-7,000 feet of elevation, I've still found them up there. So they can grow in a lot of different places. So yeah, it's one of those plants you just kind of want to, if you haven't found it, just kind of learn about and then go out looking for it. And the leaves are pretty easy to identify too, or use as an identification factor, because they, you know, in the spring, they're kind of like a rusty almost color, like I think you mentioned that earlier. And then they, as the season kind of progresses, they get like more darker green and then like a bit more yellowy, reddish again. And they have the margins on the outside. So they have like saw teeth on the outside of the margins, sawtooth. And I think in the spring is usually when I like looking for most berries, like choke cherry, and service berry and all that, because they're just so easy to see. While plums still all have like their white blossoms, their white flowers out. Often when a lot of other plants aren't really blossoming yet. So that's usually the best time, I think, to go scouting for them, at least like early spring.
Yeah.
From my experience.
Yeah. And then mid to late spring is when you pick them, and they're amazing. So that's one of the things that I really enjoyed doing. Last year was the first year I collected them. So this year I plan on going crazy on them and getting, you know, 5 gallons or so of them and just make an insane amount. And like I said, giving it as gifts and just eating a lot more of it than trying to save it and savor that flavor for as long as I can.
Right. Have you found a good way of harvesting them effectively?
The way I use now, the first couple times I picked them by hand, but if you actually get like a cranberry, like a picker, where it's it almost looks like a scoop for like chicken feed, but it's got these little rake fingers on the end of it, and just using one of those, a berry picker, works really well.
Yeah, that's one way of doing it, just like a berry rake. And then I've done in the past too with like mulberries, and I haven't done it with service berries yet, but it'll work too, I think. It's just, again, put out a big tarp and then just smack those branches with a stick or so, and all the ripe berries should fall down. You can then pick them up, put them in a bucket, you know, add some water and kind of separate the debris from the berries that way. It's a great way to do it for huckleberries too, if you get a lot of debris in your rakes. So that's something I found, at least with the rakes, is you often get a lot of like sticks and leaves and stuff in there.
I put them in a big pot in the sink and then add water to it. Yep, float them up.
And just let them dry a bit. Yeah, and we mentioned dehydrator earlier. If you have a dehydrator, the service berries, making raisins out of them is super tasty.
Do you find the seeds get kind of annoying though? Because it's got a lot more seeds, I feel like, than like a raisin. But is it bad or are they good?
I don't think so. Like, and I usually don't let them go until they're like fully dried out. I just kind of let them like dehydrate a bit, and you can often pick them like that on the shrub too, you know, like kind of sun dried already. And I don't think it's bad with the seeds at all, because I've also in the past made them where, because they're kind of like a meatier berry, you can just kind of like put them in a big bowl and get one of those mashed potato mashers and mash them up, and they'll stick together really nicely. You can make like a patty and then sun dry or dehydrate those patties, and you have like little service berry snacks, you know, that you can take along wherever you're going. And I don't think the seeds get in the way at all. But
nice. I'm gonna have to try that.
Yeah, it's really cool. Just because
maybe add some black walnuts to it. and some meat.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. It's almost like making a fruity pemmican then with some nuts in there too. But the actual like berry is so kind of mealy and sticky. Like it's not like a raspberry where you press on and it's all juice, you know, at least from my experience. So that's something I've done with them. And then I think they also freeze pretty well. I've frozen them and then just used them for like making wine. Like right now I'm about getting ready to rack a wine that, is just a mix of wild strawberries, the service berry, and huckleberries. So I haven't tasted it yet. We'll see how it tastes, but I think it'll be amazing. Pretty good.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah, for sure. Right. Just gotta try it out. I wanted to do a pure wild strawberry wine, but they take so long to pick. Like we have a good amount here, but you know, you collect for an hour and a half, and you get like a bit more than a cup, just because they're very small.
They're tiny.
They are far and in between. They're tiny, yeah. They're far and in between. So I didn't quite have enough for just a pure strawberry wine. Next year, maybe I'll have to get some helpers, or this year, actually, I should get some helpers to be like, hey, if we all pick for a day, everyone can have some of this wine, because I don't drink a bunch of it anyway. So I just feel like a wild strawberry wine would be pretty special.
You know? It would be.
All right. Cool. Well, Luke, this has been an absolute pleasure. Is there, you know, anything else that we didn't cover that you really wanted to talk about?
I mean, none that I could think of. I think we talked about the stuff that we talked about a little bit earlier. I urge anybody to get out, tap trees, get that experience, pick up a spear. If you can go on a hunt and hunt something with a spear, do it. It's absolutely amazing. It'll change your life and the way you think about hunting. Don't get wrapped up in the gore and the violence, but how quickly it dispatches an animal. And I think that's about it, man.
Now think about this. A wild boar stew, like cooked in maple sap and then some service berries in there. I think that would be pretty good. Like a service berry sauce on top, right?
I'm always bring it all together. That's what I love. Yeah.
Good. Yeah. I never get picky eaters because it's like, I mean, for me, it's all about like adventure with food, you know, trying new things, seeing how things taste. But I understand my brother's the pickiest eater in the world. Finally, he's eating deer. So
well, got that's him like that far. That's good. But like those, remember those epic bars that have like the bison and cranberries and or like venison and walnuts, like just weird combinations that you're like, oh, I don't know if I want to eat that. But then you do. I mean, it's not bad, so I could see it happening with the stew. Maybe I will try cooking some food and in the sap and see what happens.
Yeah, why not? Try it out. Heck yeah! So, where can people find your podcast and your social media and all that?
So on Facebook, there's a page called Publicly Challenged. On Instagram, it's I think Publicly Challenged or Publicly _ Challenged. And they can find the podcast on pretty much anywhere that you normally listen to podcasts, Spotify, iTunes, whatever, Apple Podcasts, all of that stuff. And then you can also go on Carbon TV. We just recently launched on Carbon TV. So you can go on there on the app, on your Vizio Smart TV, any Fire Stick or anything like that. You can go and get the Carbon TV app. And once you put that app on there, you can go to podcasts and listen to all the podcasts they have available, including Publicly Challenged.
Heck yeah. That's great to hear. And I'll put all the links in the show notes so people can check it out. Awesome. Thanks for coming on, man.
Absolutely.
All right. We've come to the end of the episode. Hope you really enjoyed it. Don't forget, you can get 15% off with Montana Block at mtblock.com. They have these wood and grain butcher blocks, specialty cutting boards, magnetic knife holders, all made from American wood and American materials. And that's 15% off with the code Year of Plenty at checkout. So again, 15% off with Year of Plenty at checkout. Also, if you got value from this podcast episode, please share it with a friend. Leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Connect with me personally. You can do that over on the social media. Instagram is probably the best place. That's at Poldy Wieland. I also have a Twitter and a Facebook for the Year of Plenty podcast. So I'll link all those in the podcast episode description. On one more thing, if you do leave a review for the podcast, send me a screenshot of it either on my Instagram or to my email address, which is theyearofplenty@gmail.com. And I will give you a link to download my free food preservation guide. All right, my friends, until next time, let's keep exploring real food together.